that secret operation with the spy Yamamoto, crossing the Kharkha River into Mongolian territory for espionage activities. If the man should leak this information, it could put me in a very uncomfortable position. However, he did not inform on me. No, as I was to discover later, he had far more grandiose plans for me. I spotted him a week later outside the station. He was in chains still, wearing the same filthy prison clothes and cracking rocks with a hammer. I looked at him, and he looked at me. He rested his hammer on the ground and turned my way, standing as tall and straight as he had when in military uniform. This time, unmistakably, he wore a smile on his face, a faint smile, but still a smile, one suggesting a streak of cruelty that sent chills up my spine. It was the same expression he had worn as he watched Yamamoto being skinned alive. I said nothing and passed on. I had one friend at the time among the officers in the camp Soviet Army headquarters. Like me, he had specialized in geography in college in Leningrad. We were the same age, and both of us were interested in making maps, so we would find pretexts now and then for indulging in a little shop talk. He had a personal interest in the strategic maps of Manchuria that the Kwantung Army had been making. Of course, we couldn't have such conversations when his superiors were around. We had to snatch opportunities to enjoy this professional patter in their absence. Sometimes he would give me food or show me pictures of the wife and children he had left behind in Kiev. He was the only Russian I felt at all close to during the period I was interned in the Soviet Union. One time, in an offhand manner, I asked him about the convicts working by the station. One man in particular had struck me as different from the usual inmate. I said he looked as if he might once have held an important post. I described his appearance. The officer, whose name was Nikolai, said to me with a scowl, "That would be Boris the Manskinner. You'd better not have anything to do with him." "Why was that?" I asked. Nikolai seemed hesitant to say more, but he knew I was in a position to do him favors. So reluctantly he told me how Boris the Manskinner had been sent to this mine. "Now, don't tell anyone I told you," he warned me. "That guy is dangerous. I'm not joking. They don't come any worse. I wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole." This is what Nikolai told me. The real name of Boris the Manskinner was Boris Gromov. Just as I had imagined, he had been a major in the NKVD. They had assigned him to Ulaanbaatar as a military advisor in 1938, the year Choi Balsan took power as prime minister. There, he organized the Mongolian secret police, modeling it after Beria's NKVD, and he distinguished himself in suppressing counter-revolutionary forces. They would round people up, throw them into concentration camps, and torture them, liquidating anyone of whom they had the slightest suspicion. As soon as the Battle of Nomonhan ended and the Far Eastern crisis was averted, Boris was called back to Moscow and reassigned to Soviet-occupied Eastern Poland, where he worked on the purging of the old Polish army. That is where he earned the nickname Boris the Manskinner. Skinning people alive, using a man they said he brought with him from Mongolia, was his special form of torture. The Poles were scared to death of him, needless to say. Anyone forced to watch a skinning would confess everything without fail. When the German army suddenly burst across the border and the war started with Germany, he pulled back from Poland to Moscow. Lots of people were arrested at that time on suspicion of having colluded with Hitler. They would be executed or sent to prison camps. Here again, Boris distinguished himself as Beria's right-hand man.